This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The term Underground Railroad evokes images of figures like Harriet Tubman engineering a daring escape in a false-bottomed carriage or enslaved people following the North Star through dark woods. Researcher and longtime history professor Adrian Israel says those popular images only tell part of the story. By poring through runaway slave ads, she found that enslaved people themselves, along with free African Americans, played an important role in helping others make it out. She also traces an underground escape network that runs close to home, right here in North Carolina's Piedmont. She's going to talk about this network at the Harry Jones Memorial Lecture on Sunday at the Cumberland County Library, that lecture hosted by the North Carolina Civil War and Reconstruction History Center. Adrian Israel, a retired Guilford County professor of history, and joins us now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
What you have discovered is a much more nuanced picture of that Underground Railroad that we have come to know. Tell us more about it.
Well, I think it's really a more accurate picture because historians had implied, if not said outright, especially John Hope Franklin, that the enslaved who stayed behind, who did not run away, the free blacks in the South had played a role in helping others escape, even though they remained in the South. And I found that an intriguing idea and got really interested in reading some of the reminiscences of Quakers who had been seen as the backbone of the Underground Railroad in North Carolina. And they're saying that they depended in large part on free black people in this process of escape.
Yeah, so tell us more about, who were freed black people in the South prior to emancipation? Talk about their communities and how they were living.
Oh, that's the crux of my research. Yeah. And what I've uncovered so far, building on research done by others, is that they lived in communities that were based in North Carolina on people who had purchased their freedom as opposed to people who were descendants of slave masters, which is more the case in South Carolina and Louisiana. So they were more likely to have kin folk who were still enslaved, to be interacting with them socially and at churches, and to have been property owners. So they were small landowners, not just tradesmen. The former picture I had of them was that they were basically blacksmiths and did work for the plantations. Many of them, let me put it this way, they are listed in the census without names. Mm. Many of the free blacks are listed without names because they lived on plantations with the enslaved. Then I discovered there were others who lived independently and were listed in the census by name and not only had trades but also had land of their own. So apparently, now my next step is to find out where they worshipped, what kind of organizations they built, and so forth.
What do we know about what part they played in what we would call this network, this underground railroad? We'll continue to use the term, even though we're changing our picture of it.
One of the main things I discovered is that from the ads themselves that were posted by slave owners, they themselves said that the runaways are likely to be posing as free blacks, to have papers that are forged, to be accompanied by free blacks, pretending to be traveling with them. And so I thought, okay, then that means that they had to be in relationship. And so one of the key roles that the free blacks played was providing them with documents, either their own or documents they borrowed or counterfeited, and also encouraging them to blend into their communities if they stayed here or to go with them north if they left.
So what were those communities like of freed blacks? Were they segregated communities or were free blacks living among whites at that time?
Well, yes, mostly here, especially in North Carolina, where there were very few cities at the time. People lived in rural areas. Right. And you can tell from the census, because the census was collected by people going from house to house, right, or farm to farm, and it's numbered. So you find clusters of maybe three or four families of free blacks living in close proximity among whites. And many of those whites, especially in Guilford County, were Quakers who had sold them land.
It would seem to me, though, that these are communities that would be under great scrutiny by the larger white communities around them. As you say, it's even in the ads for escaped slaves. Watch out. How were they able to get away with it?
And see, that's the relationship or the network or the partnership that I'm exploring. Because some of the whites who supported the Underground Railroad or not were, in fact, people who, let me put it this way, they were bondsmen. You had to have someone who spoke for you. If you were a free black person, you could be challenged. That is, especially if you were born free and didn't have a documentation from the courts that you had been freed through manumission. So there were many cases where in court records and other places where I found that there were whites who spoke for a free black person to say, yes, I verify that this man or woman was born here. I knew them growing up. So you had to have kind of a sponsor, you could say. Most of the free black people really lived through networks of themselves and also of sympathetic whites who opposed slavery, but who may or may not have spoken out against
it. So that would then speak to the role of the Quakers, at least in Guilford County,
yes,
in strengthening this network.
Yes, and I'm questioning whether I'm confident there probably were other communities of whites throughout the state who also opposed slavery, but for many reasons were afraid to speak out against it, especially as time went on, especially as you get closer to the Civil War. It's more dangerous to be an abolitionist.
I want to take us on a little tangent here because we talk about the Quakers in Guilford County who were supportive, but not all Quakers in North Carolina were necessarily supportive. There was some tension between the Quakers of Eastern North Carolina.
And there was even tension among the Quakers in Guilford County because many of them, I would venture to say most of them, opposed the Underground Railroad. They opposed illegal activity, harboring the enslaved, and they suggested that it would be better to just go through manumission, go through the courts. And, of course, in the East, there were more people who were slave owners, and in fact, slavery was more crucial to the economy in the East. So there were Quakers in the East who continued to own slaves, as there were a few in Guilford County who continued to own slaves in spite of what the church said.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. As you say, you're giving us a more complete and an accurate picture, which I think really helps us understand all of the dynamics in this period. And when I say this period, we should maybe talk about the changes over time from the early 1700s as slavery developed in North America. Talk about the ways in which the laws changed and our relationship, the relationship between slave owner and slave had to change because of those fears.
Well, actually, over time, as there were more rebellions, there were more slave rebellions, runaways were seen as a greater threat, and especially a network to support them. Many of the runaways armed themselves, and when Nat Turner's rebellion broke out in Virginia, close to the North Carolina right, line, just like the Stonewall Rebellion before in South Carolina. It struck fear into the hearts of whites in both states. And in North Carolina, a lot of laws were passed that could not be enforced, but they were very strict laws, especially the ones forbidding African Americans to vote, free or not, forbidding them to assemble in groups without white supervision, forbidding them to own firearms, and so forth. And especially, I would say, the access to education was curtailed. So the laws got tighter and stricter as time went on, but ironically, so did resistance. And so I'm kind of fascinated by that and wondering how they managed to continue after 1840 and into 1850, continue to help people escape.
Another fascinating aspect to your research that it surprised me was the number of people who would escape from a plantation but not leave the South.
That's right. The majority of people who ran away, so-called escaped from slavery, did not really intend to leave the South. Apparently, a large number were either attempting to find relatives whom they had been sold away from, or just to, how can I put it? It's like a worker slowdown in modern terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calling in sick.
Yeah.
we're not going to work. And so if enough workers did that, they knew that it would create problems for the plantation owner, but more likely it's a way to negotiate their own status with the owners. Because one of the things that we forget is that enslaved people were continually trying to negotiate better terms for themselves. If that meant going away and hiding for a month or two, there were many ads where the one searching for the enslaved person would say, this is the third time he's run away, the fourth time he's got marks on him for trying to escape, whipped them and so forth, and he keeps trying to escape. Well, it was a way to negotiate your employment terms, you could say. Even though you're not paid, even though you're enslaved, you're still a human being who's trying to negotiate. So there's ample evidence that this happened frequently as a way to just protest your working conditions.
Well, and others who actually went from really horrid conditions in one plantation, perhaps back to an earlier owner.
That's right. They tried, and so many of the people who pretended to be free did the same thing. They were part of the community disguised as free black people. Many said they were going back to a former, in fact, the ad said we're looking for them in X area because they probably went back to where they were formerly owned or where they were born. And that was true.
Wow. What surprised you? Tell us more about these ads, because it's fascinating to think about how you would advertise for this sort of thing and how much information you can glean. That was, as I began to try to imagine what you're looking at, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I wish I could see these ads.
Well, Professor Freddie Parker at North Carolina Central, who's retired as well, he started, I think, earnestly developing systematic collections of the ads. So I found some that he did not have in his collection, but he went up from 1790 to 1840, looking at North Carolina ads. So his collection is available if you want to look at some of them, but they're amazing. The detail, what Professor Parker noted was the detail in these ads about the enslaved, what they looked like, what they wore. I brought some, but I don't know if time to read from them. But some of them went into great detail about markings on their face, how they expressed themselves, whether they had stuttered or not, whether there was a dimple, and all so forth. Details about their humanity.
Let's do that. If you have them here, we'll read some of these ads that have given you greater insight into the role that enslaved people played in their own freedom, and as you say, to give them leverage and negotiating power, even in a situation where you would think you have absolutely none. Through this resilience and fair amount of imagination, we're able to find some kind of leverage.
And also the way they disguise themselves and the clothing that they took with them. I have one. I went back to 1790, and there's one 1797 says that this man is Jacob, about 22 years of age, about 5'10". He supposed he will make for Petersburg, that's Petersburg, Virginia, from Guilford County. He took with him a great quantity of fine clothes and a large sum of money. So that was one clue. And then another one talked about someone who escaped, two very likely young Negro fellows, and gives their names with them, homespun short jacket and overalls filled with yellow yarn. Tom had a light gray colored great coat and a blue broadcloth under jacket. Their other clothing I cannot describe. But these are the kinds of details, that kind of give us a better clue to the humanity of the enslaved people. You know, they didn't go in rags. Like oftentimes we hear about people arriving at the doorstep of someone on the Underground Railroad, you know, with no shoes and wearing only rags.
That may have happened once or twice, but it wasn't the whole picture.
I think what I want to say is what has really struck me. It struck me doing research for something else that they would have escaped the way people would escape now. You know, if you escape from prison, you know, you wouldn't wear your old prison garb. You would try to find some clothing. Well, they took it with them from the plantations. And one account I found of someone trying to cross the Ohio River in Maysville, Kentucky, over into Ripley, Ohio, and the conductor, who was an African-American, a free man, John Parker, wrote in his autobiography that this one woman had so many clothes. She had two great big bags of clothing that she had taken from
and she emptied the closet before
right,
she...
Exactly. He said they spent an hour almost trying to get her to leave these clothes. And he said, you're weighed on a boat. He said he had to just... And she was already a little bit of weighty, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And it was a hilarious story he told about this woman.
So how much of that information do you have from testimonies that you know, sort of first-person accounts, apart from the slave ads, obviously instructive?
Well, there are a few from Pennsylvania. I haven't found many from this area yet, of people who were helping the enslaved, mm-hmm. and they talk about how they were, the state they were in when they arrived. Mm-hmm. And usually their disguises are emphasized, especially of the men who disguise themselves as women and the women who disguise themselves as men. Mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of, I think William Steele in Philadelphia, he was careful to humanize the people that he helped, because he wanted to do that to help them find relatives and friends who would know them. So yeah, there's some of that.
What do you know? Do you know much about how North Carolina compares to other slave states in terms of these kind of networks and what you might have found in other states?
I'm not sure. I don't want to go too far, but the closer we get to this study, the more we realize that it wasn't just the border states. Usually we talk about Kentucky mm-hmm. and Maryland and the states closest to the free states. But I'm learning more and more that we need to look at all of the states. We made a lot of generalizations, especially about the lower South, that may not be true. I'm being very careful to make any speculations. But what I have discovered is many people who ran away from slavery in Virginia came to North Carolina.
They went south?
Yes, instead of going north.
Do we know why?
Good question. One speculation is, so far, I'm willing to say is that apparently there were many counties in North Carolina where the laws were not enforced. In fact, there were laws prohibiting the enslaved who were freed from remaining in North Carolina for more than 6 months or a year, or they would be re-enslaved, but it didn't happen.
You know, another interesting law, before I let you go, about the number of free blacks who came to North Carolina, black men who would marry white women, which created a change in the law. Tell us about that.
Yes, there were a large number, such a large number, in fact, at one point, that they were taxed. There was a special tax imposed on free black men and white women who were married. They had to pay an extra tax in compared to other married couples. And in fact, I found a white woman who was listed in the census as her children being fathered by an enslaved man. And she's listed in the census.
Well, so it was an official, because that would not normally turn up in the official documentation.
No, so the fact that she would have, you know, she would have the courage to be identified by name, that she would be listed, and there's no record of her being arrested.
It'd be interesting to know if North Carolina was different in that number, too. In other words, if there was something about North Carolina that made that a better place for black
what
men.
What I found about North Carolina, and I found that since I've moved here, I moved here from Ohio. I've been here about 40 years now. But what I found that North Carolina has a great deal of variety from county to county, from region to region. So there are extremes of sentiment. And if you're in the right place, especially as the Quakers began to settle the Piedmont, you find a shift in runaway slave ads toward the West. I think that's why it is said that the overland route to freedom from North Carolina was probably centered in the Piedmont, but the sea routes in the East. But you see, what people, I think, don't take into account is that it's dangerous to make too many generalizations.
Well, I'm glad you're digging down and getting the details and continue in your retirement to work hard on this. Do come back as your research evolves.
Thank you.
We're happy to have you with us. Adrian Israel, Underground Railroad scholar, retired Guilford County history professor, and continuing to be a scholar, going to deliver the Harry Jones Memorial Lecture Sunday, 2 o'clock, Cumberland County Library. Lecture hosted by the North Carolina Civil War and Reconstruction History Center. We've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org.